to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we are talking about Season 2, Episode 7, titled A Man Without Honor. Talking about Ned, quite obviously. The guy we thought was so honorable, and Jamie makes a salient point about the dishonorable nature of Jon Snow being a bastard.
Yeah, it's one of the better scenes in the episode where Jamie kind of like outlines how you're in a pickle sometimes as a knight. Like what oaths do you fulfill and what oaths do you, like, you know, if you're the Asimovian robot with the three laws, which ones take precedence? It's interesting that they start this. This is the first kind of, well, I don't know. It's interesting because it's humanizing Jaime in an episode where he kills his cousin in complete cold blood. And I love it for that reason, because they kind of refuse to put Jaime in just one box. Like, you're not ready to get out your woobies for him, but, you know, clearly there's more to him than the official kind of like Stark propaganda about Jaime Lannister. And it's great.
Absolutely. And they've been doing, I think, some of that stuff with, you know, Tywin as well. In the Arya scenes, you can see that he's not just this cold-blooded monster, but there is that element to him. And I think they're doing a lot of, like, father-like-son sort of stuff here.
Yeah, and even with Cersei, like, the fact that she's afraid of her own son and afraid of what it means, the fact that he's so fucking crazy and cruel.
Cersei having an off day here on the bitch scale, right? Like, normally she's a pretty tough exterior, but it's melting a little bit.
Well, I think when you've got this existential threat on your back door and there's really nothing you can do about it.
And you sort of know you've caused the problems that are putting you in the situation to begin
with. Yeah, looking back over your life, oh, here are the things that got me here. It's probably got a way to sober up anybody.
For sure. And for all of those reasons and more, I like this episode a lot. I thought it was really good. Do you have anything else to say about it before we get into the recap?
No, let's get to the recap. I want to cover some quick housekeeping. We got so much stuff going on. Walking Dead Season 8 came back this weekend. We've already live watched it. We are ready for the podcast to come out on Tuesdays. That's going to be an every week thing until for the next 8 weeks. Mr. Robot came back last week, 2 weeks ago. And we are really digging the episode so far. We're having a great time recapping those. Those drop on Friday. Stranger Things Season 2 drops in its entirety on Friday, and Jim and I are marathoning it this weekend. Our goal is to have an episode up for every a podcast episode for every episode, complete and uploaded as we go by Monday morning. We're also going to be seeing Suburbicon this Thursday night, the new Coen Brothers written, George Clooney directed, Matt Damon starring, crazy movie. I really don't even know what it's about. But that's a pretty good pedigree, and I'm excited about it. We also last week played episode 3 of The Wolf Among Us, which is the weird kind of fantasy fable adventure game from Telltale. And I thought it was a pretty good episode. If you've never seen a Bald Move Let's Play, we try to make the worst decision possible at all times, either in terms of like what it means to be a good human being, in terms of what it means for good gameplay. We always try to do the stupidest and most dickish thing possible. Check that out for our premium club members. And also, finally, we're going to be in Huntsville, Alabama for the Rocket City NerdCon. If you go to rocketcitynerdcon.org, you can get all the information. It is the weekend of the 4th and 5th of November. We'll be at the Central Library doing panels. We're going to be doing a live podcast on Return of the Jedi. We're going to be doing our Red Wedding cosplay game show spectacular and talking about how you can succeed at podcasting. RocketCityNerdCon.org for tickets, advanced tickets to that.
Okay, we start off with Theon waking to find Asha, Hodor, Bran, and Rickon all gone. He's pissed at the guards, and he beats one of them for pointing out that he was fucking the wildling who helped them escape, and then he sends the hounds after the boys.
This is the insolent one, anyway. He probably deserved a curb stomping.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, in as much that all these Iron Islanders are probably total shits, you know, rape. Maybe there is the sense. Maybe there is the. I keep thinking of like what it would be like to be the one. like sensitive soul in this longboat. Like you're the
yeah.
What was that dude on in Saving Private Ryan, the translator?
Oh yeah,
Like Private Mellish or something like that. That's
something
not
like that.
That's not. But like, what would it be like to be that guy,
Jeremy Davies?
Yeah, I think you would be dead. You'd be you wouldn't survive the trip across the first trip across the ocean. So I'm just assuming
at the very least you'd need your own boat.
All these guys are rape and reaving experts and thus failures as human beings.
Yeah,
you can see Theon like having to be in that mold, and it's not pretty.
No, and it doesn't really fit him, honestly. He's trying to grow into it here, if you can call it growth. He's trying to be that, but you can see, I mean, especially on the look, with the look on his face at the end of the episode,
yeah,
where he sees the two burnt bodies, he is very much out of his depth here,
yeah,
even though he's trying to put up this good front.
And the other thing is, like, I remember the first time, you know, watching this or reading it, you think about Theon, like, okay, Theon maybe is all hat, no cattle most of the time, but he was mm-hmm. a pretty good hunter.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of skill for, like, the bow. And I remember being kind of, like, really afraid, like, oh, man, it's Asha and Hodor and these two boys versus Theon and what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that they did a pretty good amount of suspense here.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's leave it at that.
My preference in this scene, when you see the guard who's had a
slit throat, yeah,
yeah, when that slit's just totally thrit open.
Oh man, nothing like a slit throat.
You fucked up the fuck up.
No, that's what I do. That's what I do.
When they see this, I can't help but think they assume it was like Bran or Rickon put the knife to the throat.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's
which
the thing.
I think is pretty funny.
As the guy's like, well, it wasn't just a crippled boy. It was the giant. It's like, oh, yeah. Because we know Hodor is not exactly. Even though he's got the power to crack a walnut in his hands, mm-hmm. he's a gentle giant.
He is. He's not a killer.
No.
Okay, let's go to Asha complaining about not having enough food as they walk through a field, and they come upon a farm where Bran sent the Winterfell orphans, if you recall a couple episodes ago.
I do.
Bran doesn't want to go to the farm in order to keep them from harm, but Asha points out that they can't outrun the hounds forever. Yes, I know I've rhymed that.
Awesome.
And that's it. That's the scene.
Can't outrun hounds or Jim's propensity to rhyme. it's cool because, like I said, this walnut cracking by Hodor gives you the glimpse of his potential power. And I remember.
Yeah.
Reading and watching, it's like they kept on having these like casual feats of strength. It's like, oh man, if Hodor ever has his Lenny moment,
mm-hmm.
Mice and Men, it's going to be fucking epic. But until now, we're just content to watch him cracking walnuts with his bare hands.
Yep.
And
that becomes important later.
Yeah, it does.
It's not just
because
a flourish.
They leave it here with Bran giving very good reasons for why they shouldn't visit the farm. And Asha giving very good reasons for why they should.
Yeah, and you don't know which one they're gonna choose.
Right, because it says something. It says something about Bran and his starkness, like what kind of harm he would put others in. We're not ready to talk about it just yet.
Not quite. First, we got to talk about Jon and Ygritte waking up in the morning. Ygritte goes right back to the sexual teasing. And John gets just as annoyed as he did the night before, especially when she accuses him of being a newcomer to the North. And he gets all uppity about his blood, and she makes the point, why are you fighting us?
I think this is the first time that this has been articulated.
Yeah.
The fact that, like, you assholes built a wall.
Mm-hmm.
We get the freezing part. You get the part that's farmable for a bit of summer. What the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, you've got the blood of the first men. What is our blood made of? And, you know, like, why is the Night's Watch been kind of reduced to this? And it's a great scene because, you know, we learn through Asha, we learn through Ygritte that not all of these wildlings are just mindless killing machines. They're not they're not like fucking Greyjoys, for example.
Okay. Sure.
They have a culture that actually has a lot of appeal to the modern ear.
Hmm. Yeah, freedom.
Yeah, it's a democrat, like, you know, like John tries to make it king versus king, but Ygritte's like, you know, we chose this guy.
Yeah.
We had a fucking process. There was a fair and open election. Even giants were heard from. You know?
Yeah, and I'm trying to figure out how much Ygritte is trying to not talk her way out of the situation, because I don't think she believes that's going to work, but like trying to educate John in a way that might soften him toward the feelings of the wildlings.
No, yeah, she's definitely...
Because there are a couple of moments in this episode where she's doing that kind of stuff.
There's definitely seduction, but there's also just kind of genuine outrage that this guy thinks he's better than me. Mm-hmm. Like, that's always, like, you know, that's a galling situation, whether you're... It's, like, I think of, like, people in my life I've met that think they're better than me in, like, an office situation or whatever, and how, like, infuriating it is. And then extend that to, like, what if they actually have you in bondage and they're treating you this way? Like, wow, mustn't that be a fucking trip and a half? But no, I like that you kind of get that she's kind of playing both sides.
Yeah, she's really twisting John up from every angle.
Blue balls, actual medical condition. Is this a threat to young men's health everywhere?
The blue stones? I don't know what balls are.
The blue stones.
I only know what stones are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the North.
It's a life-threatening condition.
I don't know that it comes from not using your stone and bone, but I think it's more the cold.
I think the incidence of blue stones is roughly, is about happens as often as just the tip intercourse.
Yes, yes. Those are one correlation.
They are a malady that they have the same... It's essentially the same purpose.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
All right, let's move on to Tywin. His forces are torturing people to try and find out who it was that tried to assassinate him. For some reason, he thinks this was targeting him. He tells the Mountain to burn the villages and the farms because he thinks it was the Brotherhood Without Banners. So he sits with Arya, and they talk about his own legacy as well as the legacy of the Targaryens, while Arya sort of looks for an opportunity to kill him still.
Yeah,
it really changed my mind about where Arya sits on that fence. I think she's over the fence and she's ready to kill Tywin.
Oh, I think if she had a good enough opportunity, she would.
Yeah, I think I had said like last episode, maybe I doubted if she would be able to do it now that they're kind of warming up to each other a little bit. But very clearly the scene is telling us she's ready.
And I think that I think you were right last episode. The thing that's changed is now Tywin's on high fucking alert. Like this cloak and dagger stuff, there's not how much longer does she think she can, like, maybe steal orders and getting them out to Rob? So now it's like, what's the next most maximum good thing I can do? Probably taking out their best military leader.
And I guess it's indirectly, or maybe not so, Arya's fault that all of these villages and farms are going to get burned, yeah?
Kind of, yeah.
Because she stole this thing. She assassinated that guy, his second command or whatever.
It's these unintended consequences, right?
It is, yeah.
But I also think it's interesting what it tells us about Tywin, because Tywin kind of rides to the rescue when, like, all the innocent people are getting tortured, and you think, oh, well, this is a lord that's kind of a cut above the others. But then we see how thin that veneer is, and also what he really likes doing, which is using, you know, Gregor Clegane as his heavy.
Yeah.
Like, he keeps his hands clean by saying, oh, I got this bannerman that's always running loose, and... Uh-huh. You know, he can always plausibly deny his activities, or if he needs to offer him up in some kind of exchange with the greater lord. He's a real son of a bitch.
And I think he's also a tactician. I mean, he obviously is, but you can see it in the way you mentioned how he comes in and he sort of puts a stop to the torturing of people, and yet here he is torturing people, but now it's with a purpose.
Yeah.
I think what he didn't like about the torturing before was A, they couldn't afford to spare the prisoner slaves, essentially, and B, it was pointless. There was no purpose behind it. It was torture for torture's sake, and that was not something he was interested in.
That's true. Although now it's like, yeah, it's torture for torture's sake, but you're now burning, you're going to be burning farms and villages just cause to.
Well, to send a message, you know? I mean, there was no message being sent when people were having rats tearing through their guts. Now there's a message that Tywin is trying to send. And, you know, it's a grim message, and it's a horrible thing he's doing.
Right. Like, he's like, you know, it's just so indiscriminate, the fact that your village could not be harboring the Brotherhood Without Banners and not aided them in any way, and you still get torched because you won't give them up because you can't give them up.
Yeah.
It's a small distinction.
For sure.
Arya continues to impress Tywin, and she's playing a dangerous game here because she continues to betray more and more. And then, like, I feel like it's weird because it's a defiant way. Like, she continues to display her intelligence and her education in contradiction of what she should be as a commoner. And, like, Tywin's kind of, over the last few episodes, given her explicit instructions on, like, oh, well, you shouldn't be able to read. And if you're read, you shouldn't if you can read, you shouldn't be well-read. And even if you're well-read, you shouldn't know, like, in-depth Westerosi history. And you certainly shouldn't be saying my lord versus my lord. And Arya doesn't give a fuck. And, like, he even says, like, you're playing a dangerous game. And she's like, damn right, old man, I am. But Tywin's got this weird attraction. Like, he sees a weird reflection of Cersei's kind of headstrongness and frustration at being, you know, a woman in a man's world. But I got the impression that Tywin's warmer to Arya than he's probably ever been to Cersei.
Seems like it.
Is that, like... I mean, I'm not a dad that's, like, particularly hard on my son. I don't think so. He might tell you otherwise. Certainly by my dad's standards. Of course, my dad, as he administered meaning beatings, would love to tell me that, oh, you think this is bad? We should see what the granddad is doing. So, yeah. Generations of bullshit. Anyway.
Yeah, probably. He's sterner with her.
But I wonder, like, if you got, like, this neighborhood kid where, like, you can kind of, like, you don't give a shit if they turn out to be, like, this kid doesn't have the weight of your legacy on them.
Yeah.
So you can just appreciate for what they are and, like, spoil them. And it's like, if they turn out to be rotten, who gives a shit? You think it's that? Or
I think so.
Is he just getting soft in his old age? And
well, he is talking about this being the last war, you know, that he'll fight in. So
is he trying? Is he an old man trying to get the Westerosi Seven Heaven? What
maybe make up for lost time here?
If I give this urchin a bit of fatherly attention, then all the other shit I've done in my life.
Maybe. I mean, it probably does come down to that idea of legacy, and I feel like he would be sterner on Cersei because of it. Because he's seen here admiring Aegon for the legacy that he left behind,
right?
No one in 300 years has forgotten Aegon,
right?
Because of the things he did, and Tywin wants to be that. He admires him,
right?
So yeah, legacy super important for Tywin.
Yeah,
if he didn't already know it.
His the dynasty he wants to form for his legacy.
We go over to Sansa, who thanks the Hound for saving her, and he doesn't so much accept the apology as try to intimidate her and call her father a liar. Not great with accepting apologies, the Hound.
Is he embarrassed at his concern, like the concern for Sansa? Is he like, because when he said at the end, it's like, you know, you think I'm this remorseless killer, you'll be glad of that when I'm all that stands between you and your beloved king. Is he already looking to the future and being like, man, this is going to be like all kinds of ugly? And I kind of got to harden my heart a little bit, or I'm not going to be able to do this job. Like, what's
his deal?
Yeah, it
could be. I mean, I read it as definitely keeping her at arm's length. And for whatever reason, you know, he does. I think if he weren't the Hound, if he weren't scarred emotionally as much as he is physically, he probably would warm up to her a bit more. But he doesn't see allies anywhere in this city, and he doesn't want allies. He wants isolation. He wants to just be the Hound.
Yeah.
So he's trying to push her away gently, I think.
I also think that he says, it's a joy to kill, and it's the sweetest thing there is. But I also think that the way he dispatched those other guys was a little bit more personal, because them trying to, like, rape this innocent girl is deeply offensive to what Sandor, like the code he holds into himself. But he did ride down to Butcher's Boy in pretty much cold blood. And I'm trying to think, is he a Jaime type that is like, again, his brother, the anointed knight who held his face down on the brazier and burnt him as a small boy? Is he just really jaded about what it means to be a knight? Is he like mostly an asshole that every once in a while has a moment or two of grace? Or
I think that's pretty close to it.
Yeah,
maybe he feels for Sansa because she was defenseless, much like he was when he was burnt. But I don't know. He's a tough nut to crack.
He sure doesn't like being related to, though.
No, he does not. And he'll call your father a liar for it.
Do you think old Ned enjoyed killing?
No. No, I think the Hound has warped his idea of people.
Yeah.
He has warped sensibilities.
I mean, I've heard many a warrior say it's a hell of a lot of fun to kill people that you are morally justified to kill. Yeah. And I've always wondered, like, is that like some kind of like true in a savage heart of you, like, you never feel more alive than when you're taking a life? Or is that like bravado so they can do like sometimes like this hard shit is just because this is an almost impossible thing to do to retain your humanity, so you wrap this kind of grim irony about you? Or
I don't know. I mean, is I it think a deeper a lot of truth? People react differently to those yeah. things, right? And I never saw anything from Ned that would make me say he enjoyed the act of killing anyone.
I mean, like, maybe this is just bravado, but, like, there is a bit when he was squaring off with Jaime, like, I'm going to fucking enjoy taking this pretty boy apart. Or, you know, when Jaime threatened him, is like, oh, you know, it's like, I never fight in tourneys because I don't want people to know, like, when it's killing time, when the killing time Ned comes out, I don't want motherfuckers to know. Like,
right.
I think maybe the Hound is a little bit more like, because it does seem like that Ned and Robert really did like riding around with the Warhammer and the Longsword and busting Targaryen heads what needed to be busted.
Yeah, maybe. It's a long time ago, but maybe there was some of that left over in old Ned.
It's just, yeah, in the Tupperware that's Ned's heart, there was some leftover pieces of brutality that you take out. And microwave and, oh, yeah. So good.
All right, let's move on to Duck Sauce pledging to help get Dany's dragons back, but she really doesn't care. She does not want his help.
Really didn't leave this mystery as long as I had thought before I rewatched this thing.
Yeah.
Like, my memory is, like, there was a few episodes of, like, who done it. Mm-hmm. But really, the mystery doesn't last but maybe a full episode if you compare
generous, time,
you know.
Yeah.
So, bully for that, but yeah. So, Zaro... and that's a thing, like, I feel like that a lesser show would have had this scene, but then Zara would have fooled Dany into trusting her again, mm-hmm. and laid out all these logical reasons of why he wouldn't have betrayed her, and then they would have kept this like a bit of a cliffhanger mystery. But this show, you know, Dany's like, no fucking way. Like, I can't trust anyone in this city.
Yeah. Including Jorah.
Anyone. Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, it's a logical reaction now. It's not a useful one, but mm-hmm. it's, and I like that they give her that moment that she doesn't, like, turn right to the first person who offers false comfort.
Yeah, and I feel like the plan might have been altered along the way, Darth Vader style. Somewhere along the way, maybe in this very scene when he's on these stairs, he realized Dany is not amenable to this idea anymore, and stealing her dragons was actually a big mistake. I think what his plan was is to help her get them back,
right,
and return them in exchange for becoming the queen and him the king.
But that's not what the warlock's plan was it?
No, but I'm wondering if the plan changed along the way once they saw, oh, Dany is not going to cooperate. As a matter of fact, she doesn't want help from anyone anymore.
Right.
I don't know.
It makes you wonder how stable the ruling 13 ever were, because it seemed like all it took is a couple of house cat-sized dragons and a slight blonde woman to completely have them eating each other alive. And there's no real defense against it.
No.
Like, you know, these guys are talking a lot of shit about these warlocks, and he diced them up good with his charlatan tricks.
Yeah, he's got 12 copies of
himself. Like, you can laugh at Penn and Teller all you want until they split themselves into 13 parts and put a knife through your belly.
Uh-huh.
Then it's like, oh, yeah, talk a lot of shit about my red pinky nail, didn't you? Deep Penn Jillette cut there.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move back to Ygritte, who is extolling the virtues of being free, as she describes it, and offers to teach John how to bang, which he does not accept.
Oh, an iconic scene. This Jon Snow,
it sure is.
Like, I know, I mean, I don't think it's spoiler to say that, like, that was an instant meme.
Yeah, you know nothing. Just do a Google search for You Know Nothing, or don't, because
there's a Bald Move t-shirt that's based on that joke.
Sure is.
So, yeah, it's... and I forgot that it was all in relation to John being a virgin.
Yeah.
He was essentially busting his chops for being sexually inexperienced.
Yeah, I can't remember. Honestly, I can't remember if they use this more in, like, different scenarios to reference different things. But it seems...
It's just,
yeah, I'm surprised, I guess.
It's a badass line said by a badass. Uh-huh. Like Ygritte, even though that John's got the power in a situation, she's kind of telling him that, you know, she's not being intimidated by him.
No.
And not only not being intimidated, but being empowered enough to be like flirty and try to, like, you know, argue politics with him. So it's just it's a great.
I mean, there's no way you're going to be intimidated by a guy whose first action is to refuse to kill you when the threat of death is the only threat that you're concerned about.
Yeah.
You already know that the worst fate is not going to befall you. So press your luck.
Yeah. I always thought it was interesting, borderline unbelievable that, like, John's personal prohibition against bastardry is so strong that he's literally never lain with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that, like, Theon, infamous whorehound.
Yeah.
I think they talk about his brothers visiting.
Bran and Rickon.
Yeah. Rickon may be a bit young, but, you know, when they're youngest of that many brothers, weird shit happens. I mean, I guess that in as much as Ned is this paragon of virtue, that always kept his word and even when it cost him, mm-hmm. That his son, John, would have the same kind of tenacity if he got in his head that being a bastard is the worst thing in the world, then I would never, ever, the thing that would really stain my honor more than anything is to make one. Even without the vow to the Night's Watch, he'd taken this personal vow that it's like, you know, marriage or bust, I guess. And now the marriage is out of the equation, so it's just bust.
All right, we go to Rob's messenger reporting that Cersei tore the paper in half when he presented it to her. He plans to reward him for his service with a hot meal and a clean pin, but Jaime's occupying it. So Rob says, put him in with Jaime anyway and have Carr Stark's son guard them. All of his men walk off, and Talisa comes to Rob to ask him to get medical supplies on his next stop. Going to the crag, the aggro crag. He's got to fight Blaze and Nitro. He invites her with him to get what she needs instead of leaving her there and just taking the list.
You can see the fractures in John's alliance here. That, like, even if the men themselves love him, some of these guys are, you know, we're getting a lot of prisoners, Your Grace. Yeah. We got a lot of problems. And the side eye that Roose gave him when Talisa went into his tent alone, like, Kat's told him, mm-hmm. Rob's on the verge of throwing his kingship in serious disarray.
Yeah,
and this is before Jaime starts rampaging through the camp too. Mm. This is all bad, and he's not around. He's traipsing with this foreign woman, which makes it even worse. It's a very untenable political situation.
Yeah, and the other part of this scene with the messenger, I think, is important to Rob's character as well. He is not one to kill the messenger,
even though the messenger kind of expected it.
He does, yeah. He totally thinks if he says anything negative here, he's done.
Yeah.
But Rob shows him that he's a better person than that. And he's also, you know, pretty deferential to Talisa, who is helping the Lannister troops as well as his own, right?
Which is another political cost for him because his men are observing the fact that, well, it's not just our troops she's helping.
Yeah. So we go over to Theon. The Hounds have lost the scent of the boys. I'm going to call this guy the devil on Theon's shoulder. he finds some walnut
Dagmar
shells.
Dagmar
Cleftjaw?
Yeah, that's his name.
Jesus, okay. Does he have, like, a cleft?
No, he doesn't. No. Like, in the books, he's got this fucking hideous scar where his, like, jaw's literally been cleaved in two with a axe back in his youth. Hmm. So he's got this, like, bizarre whole mouth assembly, which probably would have been a bitch and a half to do makeup-wise, but...
Yeah.
Well, not the last time I will look at a person that I thought about what they looked like in the books and be like, huh.
Yep.
Okay, well, guess you can't act with a split jaw.
So Theon sends Maester Luwin home so that he can commence the torturing of people in peace, because Maester Luwin is just really putting up a stink about it.
Yeah, he's got these, you know, this prohibition about butchering the children that he's raised from pups.
How do you get anything done with him around?
I know.
Anything else in that scene, or should we go to Jorah?
The question that was contemporaneous here was, are we to believe that Bran betrayed what he thought was the better counsel as far as these farmers and put them in danger? Or was old Dagmar here clever enough to plant some walnuts?
I just don't know how he could have possibly known that they were eating walnuts unless they found them along the way. Which might have happened. The dogs might have had the scent.
That's right, because the scene where he was pounding walnuts, that's not something that any of them would have been privy to.
No, it's out in a field. Now, the dogs could have found him, and he could have scooped him up and said, sure, I'm going to use these later.
Sure. I remember there was a lot of like debate about whether this guy had a bead, or he was up to something.
I think
no
it's a
good
fair question, because he's clearly up to something. Yeah. I want to know what his end game is here, because he's pushing Theon down a very specific path,
right?
And I'm not sure that's one that's meant to help him at this point. We'll see, I guess.
And the whole thesis about better to be cruel than weak is interesting, because I think that's probably true. That's certainly Tywin's thesis. But the problem is when you're both cruel and weak. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a meta commentary on, like, Joffrey. It's also one about Theon, that, like, it's probably better to be meek, be weak and amiable than weak and cruel.
Sure.
It's probably better to be, like, just and even-handed in all the things you do. But if you want to choose like one toxic kind of philosophy, you can only do one.
Yeah.
If you try to, because that's the thing, like Tywin's fairly even-handed, but he can be cruel. If you try to Joffrey or Theon, and it's going to be bad news.
Yeah, at least if you're weak and amenable, you'll have allies,
right?
You know,
right?
Who can ward off anybody?
But that's
who...
what Tywin saw firsthand, the limitations of his father, like, you know, being in his mind weak, because you get taken advantage of too.
And I wonder how much of that ties into some of the stuff that Cersei says later to Sansa about, you know, the not being weak and only loving your children,
right?
You know, essentially, love is weakness.
Right, yeah.
But you don't have a choice in your children, so deal with that weakness.
Right. Yeah. That's the only, but that's the ones you can't get out of. Everybody else, nah.
Nah. Okay, we go to Jorah returning after hearing about Dany's dragons. Dany is sad that she caused her servant's death, essentially. And Jorah says these people aren't her friends, which makes Dany realize she doesn't want to trust anyone anymore. Jorah begs to help her, and she says, if you want to help me find my dragons.
Yeah, she also checks him pretty hard, too, because he's talking the truth that, like, you can't be this wretched, paranoid person because you're very weak right now, and you need friends. You can't be cruel and weak. Like, you know, everybody knows that, Dany. And he's trying to approach her, but she also has kind of seen this fundamental truth that he is also too wrapped up in her.
Yeah.
And he thinks, like, you know, he's got the temerity to think that he can, like, put his hands on her shoulder and there, like a little girl.
Yep.
So he does, like, you know, he finally finds a way to say, like, it's not, okay, fine, I'll step back, but you still need somebody to help you. Find my dragons. Is that the imperative form of where is my dragons? I feel like that's like a partial credit on the where is my dragon scale.
Yeah, I could buy that.
All right.
I'm just trying to inflate the numbers.
Because find my dragons implies that I don't know where they are.
Sure, yeah.
So, like, the sentiment is just...
Unless it's hide and seek. And then,
it's like,
oh, like I've
where
hidden
are my dragons?
Dragons?
I want you to do something about it.
All right, we go back to Ygritte, who is teasing Jon by describing what she's going to say to the Night's Watch when they return. It's all very embarrassing to him. And she uses that embarrassment as an opportunity to escape and leads Jon into a group of wildlings who, I assume, take him captive. The tables have turned here.
Yeah.
We don't see John again, as I recall.
Now she's the better one.
Yeah.
Also, I love her fairly good Kit Harington imitation.
It was good.
When she's, like, spinning this tale about him, like, ravishing her, and he's like, he says, turn around, he goes, and I thought we were done, and then he said, turn back around. It's really funny.
Yeah, no, she is awesome. I'm a big fan of Ygritte.
Yeah, and you get to, like, I mean, in my head canon, she has somehow detected her people in a way that Jon could not, and played her hand right then. This wasn't like a desperation thing?
No.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because you can see at some point during this episode, she begins leading him. Mm. And I knew immediately that that was a mistake. I saw her going out ahead of him, and I'm like, you're not leading her anymore, man. Which means she is, by definition, leading you.
Probably into a trap.
Yeah, and she knows the area much better than you do. So
it's almost like Jon Snow doesn't know anything.
Yeah. So Sansa is reliving her experiences in a dream, and she wakes up to her first period, and Shay comes in and tries to help her hide it, and another handmaiden sees it, and she goes to tell Cersei, and Shay stops her, but the Hound has also seen it. Shay does not go up and put a knife to the neck of the Hound.
It'd be funny if she did, though. So the Hound, is this a morning ritual? Like, he gives the handmaid, like, okay, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to go in there and give it a quick look, and then I'm busted in with my armor. Because he's got that bed on, like, lockdown.
Yeah. It might be. I mean, it might be an assignment from Joffrey.
Yeah, tell me when the girl bleeds.
Or Cersei, more likely.
The real shit job you got there, Hound.
Yeah.
Also, really interesting character beat for Shay.
Yes, she was totally tolerable in this scene. I liked it.
Yeah, like, I mean, even as an avowed Shay hater, I gotta say that, like, I don't know what the depth is, but, like, anyone who instantly and empathetically sees what's going on here, mm-hmm. and, like, no question, just like, okay, how can I help this, shield this little girl? Not completely terrible in my book.
Yep. I liked it. All right, we move on to Cersei describing to Sansa what it was like to have Robert's children, and she tells her that Joffrey is going to be terrible and advises her to love no one but her children. And I really, really love the moment at the end where she says, I thought I had to love Joffrey, and she says, you can try.
Yeah.
Just like she tried to love Robert, you know? She's actually doing a very kind thing here and trying to give her advice as much as she knows how.
Yeah, it's from a very... I mean, she is actually... this is... Sansa doesn't realize it, but, like, this is Cersei leveling with her from her personal experience. It's all really fucked up and fatalistic and, like, what can you do in this society we live in? But it is advice that is coming from her heart and from a place where she's clearly reflecting upon the failures of Joffrey and herself, and mm-hmm. And also shows... Now, the really interesting thing is what this says about her relationship with Jaime, because it really, like it's funny because she talks about all this stuff in front of the Sansa, who doesn't know, or I don't know if she does believe that Joffrey is actually... I don't know if she fully grasped all that court intrigue, but Cersei's kind of really plainly saying, like, here's how it happened. Like, you know, Robert fucked off to his hunt, and my brother, Lover, was with me for all of our children's birth. So she tells that story, but then she doesn't really carve a Jaime-sized exception for the don't love anyone but your children.
That's true.
Rule.
Yeah.
And it's also in an episode where Jaime retreats to the moral high ground by saying, I've only been with one woman who I've loved, which is my sister. You can't say the same thing about Ned. It's like, not a huge, because again, you know, this is delivered to an audience that doesn't fully appreciate the situation, but I think it's interesting that where in an episode where Jaime, you know, declares his love for Cersei, there's a little bit of a wiggle room in her love contract.
Yeah, for sure. And we've seen, you know, maybe not incontrovertible proof, but certainly implied that Lancel has been sleeping with her.
I mean, unless Lancel's just fucking, like...
right.
I'm not even sure if I did have sex with her, but, like, Tyrion seems like he's sure I better be afraid. Like, yeah.
Yeah, who are they going to believe, me or Tyrion?
It's like, he's, like, a whole other levels of stupid if he's able to be blackmailed with something he didn't do.
Right. So, yeah, there's definitely... there's an imbalance there, for sure. So we go to Jaime and the messenger, who turns out to have squired for him once, and they're getting reacquainted. He huddles closer and closer to Jaime while they trade squiring stories, and when he gets close enough, Jaime kills him and uses his body to get the guard inside the cell, where he also kills the guard and escapes. And if you hadn't caught it earlier in the episode, this guard is actually Lord Karstark's son.
Sure is.
Which becomes important in following scenes.
Yeah, this is a great scene, because number one, it works in two ways. The first time you see it, it's fucking shocking.
Yeah.
Like, it comes out of nowhere. You think there's going to be this, like, Lannister romp, like the Duke boys. Mm-hmm. And he just whispers that you've got to die and beat and savagely beats him down.
Looks him right in the eyes too before he does it.
Right.
To see if the kid comprehends what he's about to do.
And like you always think in terms of like killers, like we talked about, like, you know, if you're a soldier or whatever, like it behooves you to kind of dehumanize and detach yourself from the humanity of the people you're killing. Mm-hmm. Jamie does the opposite. He like turns the empathy up to full to pull this kid into his confidence so he can beat him the fuck to death. And yep. It's like the kid's like still twitching on the ground when Karstark boy comes in there to see what's up.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
And so it's like it's shocking, but then every time you see it afterwards, you just think like, Jesus Christ, what is Jamie's damage that he's capable of something like this?
Yeah.
And like this like and again, we've seen him throw a kid out the window. And just when you think, you know, like this episode is kind of like asking you to see things from Jamie's side, but also to recoil from the horror that is the thing that he's become. Mm-hmm. It's a great scene, and it does a lot. Like it does a lot of world building because it talks about, you know, Barristan Selmy, the old Lord Commander, what like a badass he was in his youth, and
painter.
how Jamie idolized this man who we've seen as a man of integrity and honor. Mm-hmm. And then you think, like, you know, like in a different world, he could have been the next, you know, Lord Commander, like this untouchable paragon of virtue, Lord Commander.
Yeah.
But it didn't work out that way.
No, it sure didn't. So we go to Jorah. He goes to the masked woman, whose name I don't remember.
Quaithe,
to find Dany's dragons. The woman reveals that she knows Jorah betrayed Dany and tells him that the thief is with Dany now. And in the next scene, we see that she's with the council, so we don't really know who the hell it is.
I thought...
which I thought was pretty nice.
Like, I don't know that they know what to do with this Quaithe character, because, like, I'm like, oh, this is an interesting mystery, but then Dany is literally with the entire 13. So yeah. Then I'm starting to roll my eyes. It's like, well, she's with everyone. But before the scene is up, we know exactly the jig, and it, too, is up.
Right.
So
right.
The Quaithe scene's kind of just an excuse to see Quaithe's ass painting, uh-huh. You know, work that she does.
Yeah, what's that all about?
Well, I mean, so she talks about the sailor going to Old Valeria, which, mm-hmm. if you are new to the world of Ice and Fire, that's where the Targaryens came from originally. Some 300-ish years ago, the Targaryens had a prophecy that something bad is going to happen to their homeland. They took off for Westeros and conquered it, and that, you know, Tywin was talking about that. But Valyria blew up, like some kind of weird, either, you know, delving too deeply in a kind of a Tolkien dwarves fashion, or some kind of magical mishap, or maybe just a Pompeii situation. The whole fucking, like subcontinent blew up.
Yeah.
And is nothing but a smoking chain of islands now that is considered to be cursed. So apparently this guy's going to be sailing through or around those cursed seas, and he's wanting magical protection. Mm. Whether Quaithe is like legit or not, who knows? I mean, that's a little Chinese fortune cookie when she essentially says, the answer is in the next scene. exit stage left, Sir Jorah.
Yeah, the intrigue is gone by the end of it, and I guess purple-lipped freak is, you know, he says the dragons are in the House of the Undying. And that's where Dany's going. She's been invited, and let's call it invited. I don't know how much of an invitation and more of a demand it is, but we'll see. So Jaime's caught, and he's dragged back to the camp. Lord Karstark wants to kill Jaime for killing his son, but Catelyn demands that he stand down, and he goes with it, but he's also going to tell Rob when he gets back and demand that he gets Jamie's head. See how that goes.
Yeah, before we... this last scene where, you know, the ruling merchants, the 13 ruling merchants are killed and Duck Sauce becomes king. They don't really talk about what the warlock's plan is here. Because it's like, I just want you to care for the dragons, get them to be big and strong. And it's weird because it's like feels like Dany's own story is being hijacked. Mm-hmm. Like she's gone from Khaleesi to being kind of a pawn in these like pimp games that these guys are playing. Mm-hmm. And it's also weird because like again, if it's that easy to do a coup on Karth, it must happen like every second Tuesday.
Yeah, that was my thought. It seems like it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, like I feel like, and it's been a long time since I've read the book, but I feel like that this scene's a bit threadbare because it dispenses with what's supposed to be a lot of intrigue and just kind of takes the barest kind of factual account of what's going on and throws it up in a single episode.
Yeah,
you can really feel, and it's rare in these early seasons, but you can really feel kind of like the streamlining in some of these scenes.
Hmm.
And I don't know that they work quite as well as they would hope.
Yeah, it did happen surprisingly fast.
I mean, I like my memories of Danny's plot this season are kind of not great, and I think these are examples why. It's just like the Quaithe. Why did the Quaithe scene even exist?
Yeah. I guess it's just to show Jorah's devotion, that he is out there trying to find those dragons and the lengths he's willing to go to.
Yeah, right. But because she asked him to find her dragons and he went to the... that's the other thing is, like, why did he go to Quaithe? Like, why was that the first place he went to search? Like, there's
she
a lot of...
She seemed to have
of...
some insights that he... Like, into his whole situation. So maybe he thought, man, she knows a lot. I'm going to go to her first.
Right. And she's like,
and
you know,
he's willing to threaten to kill her.
What if Quaithe said, are you going to betray her again? He's like, maybe. Or like, well, you're
why don't
the,
you tell me?
Yeah, you're the bejeweled warlock woman. Why don't you tell? Yeah, exactly. It's just like, it's just some really kind of loosey goosey plotting going on here.
Yeah. All right. Did you want to say anything about the scene with Jaime and
no,
Lord
just
Karstark
how like,
his head?
Legitimately pissed Karstark is, and how like Kat has to play every card in that she's got in her hand to keep the peace in Rob's camp with him being gone, and even then, it's not going to last 24 hours. It's kind of incredible how quickly this falls apart.
It's also, man, Kat is on real thin ice in this conversation because she. As I recall, in season one, took Tyrion captive, maybe against better judgment.
Oh, yeah. She's totally a loose cannon.
Right. And now she's saying that this is not the smart thing to do. And she says she understands, but does she? Like, she understands, but she's not allowing him the same latitude that she would want.
It's just, I guess, when I was reading and watching this, I just felt very bitterly disappointed in Rob's leadership here.
Yeah, why is
that? And
gone?
I'm not saying Rob's leadership. I'm like the northern lords he has. Like this Karstark guy, how can he not see the big picture?
Right.
That killing Jaime Lannister for fucking revenge is not going to advance. It's not going to bring your child back from the dead. It's not going to advance your military goals. In fact, it's probably going to just immediately wind up getting the Stark girls killed.
Yeah.
And it's always frustrating that, maybe that's one of Martin's things. Like, yeah, these feudal systems suck. Because, like, it's Karstark isn't the smartest, most level-headed, reasonable guy. He's just
next
kind of a
line.
Warlord, and he's backing Robin so much as it's going to give him it's disappointing, but maybe probably an accurate depiction of what it looks like to have.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't begrudge him too much for letting emotion get in the way of the level head that he should have, with his son being freshly dead. But you know, he should see the bigger picture, and I hope that maybe. Before Rob gets back, he will.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, it's so weird. It's like, I guess you're right. Like, I get, if he's making purely emotional appeals, but he's also trying to cloak it, like, since when is it treason to kill Lannisters? Like,
that's too much.
Come on. Like, I get that you're clouded by emotion, but don't fucking tell me you're stupid.
Yeah.
Because that's the one thing I really have hard time respecting about characters in television, when they're just fucking dumb.
And
or,
it wasn't the
or
mention...
Or they think the other person's dumb enough to be like, oh, well, fair point. Have his head,
right.
Sir Karstark. Like, come on.
And he's not even responding to the thing they took issue with, which was him saying, essentially, that Rob has this whore that he's sleeping around with and he's fucking everything up. That was the treasonous part.
Right.
It wasn't about, like, killing Lannisters. Of course, that's not treason.
Right.
But, yeah, he's a little cloudy here.
The other thing I wonder if they're trying to hint is, because we've talked about this before, the fact that the North doesn't have as many, like, traditions as far as knights. Like, Sir Roderick is kind of an aberration that he actually is knighted. most Northerners don't like that. Knighting is essentially a religious office that you hold, and it's a Southern tradition. And I wonder if they're trying to show, because Kat's making a point of calling him Sir, which she's a lady from the South. She's trying to be courtly towards this guy. And like, I wonder if low key, like if you're a Game of Thrones fan that's actually a fan of the books, if you're supposed to see like kind of wince a bit at that like Kat is almost insulting this guy, but she's trying to be polite, and there's like there's this real cultural kind of thing, because you know Karstark seems like he's kind of a Northern nationalist. He doesn't care much for this Southern wife of Ned Stark's. Certainly doesn't care much for this foreign woman that his king's traipsing around with.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's something intentional, I think it's a really good subtle thing that they put in there.
Well, I mean, shame on Karstark. He's setting people up for that.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to be a Northern loyalist and you're also going to be a knight, you got to expect for some people to be a little confused.
Right. But that's the thing. I don't think Karstark is. I think she's calling him Sir, but he's not.
Yeah, yeah.
I also liked Jamie's you've turned into a real she-wolf, not much fish left in you, which is a joke about her, you know, House Tully's symbol is a trout or a fish.
Yep. So we find out that Stannis' fleet is sailing north, and Tyrion is trying to figure out what to do about it. And he tells Cersei that Joffrey needs to start acting like a king. Cersei says Joffrey doesn't listen to her and worries aloud that this might be the price for having children with Jamie, and then she breaks down into tears. This is a great scene, I thought.
Yeah.
I felt like Tyrion maybe cut her a little bit too deep in this scene with that line about it's hard to put a leash on a dog once you put a crown on its head.
Right.
Because she has not been an effective mother for Joffrey, apparently.
Yeah.
Certainly has not led him down the right path. And now that he has all this power, what's his incentive to ever listen to anyone?
And it's a great scene because... like, you got these two characters who are family, but they also have this massive antagonistic relationship.
Yeah.
And this is where, like, the earlier statements I made, like, what if Tyrion had, like, been a touch less Tyrion in his victorious, you know, conquering of King's Landing? Because I think Cersei kind of desperately wants to level with him and to connect with him, have someone understand the position she's in, and she's really being vulnerable here.
She is.
And like, I think also towards the end of the scene, like the way Peter Dinklage plays, like he's like slowly taking steps towards her. Mm-hmm. Like the human thing would, as her brother, would be to hug her and comfort her. But she's kind of a snake, too, so, like, I can't quite do it. And when she looks at me, I have to look away. Like, it's just, like, this weird, very ill-fitting, her, like, it's like if they literally were trying to dance. Like, she's way too tall, he's way too short, it's just not going to work.
Right.
And I really like that. And it's a tragedy, because, again, if Cersei were just slightly less smug and shitty, like, maybe they wouldn't be in this position. If Tyrion was slightly less smug and shitty, maybe they wouldn't be in this situation.
Yeah, and I especially like that line that I said about the dog, because it applies both to Joffrey and Cersei, as well as Cersei and Tyrion, right?
Right.
I mean, they have years of built-up animosity. It's not going to go away overnight, even though it's needed.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's also the introduction of the theme of the Targaryens, too, because I don't know if they've articulated this before, but, you know, we've heard about the Mad King and, like, Dany's... His child and how the, you know, Jaime and Cersei have told themselves, like, oh well, we're no worse than the Targaryens, and look how and look what they became. They conquered all of Westeros. But the flip side is, yeah, the incest, you know, as we know, can lead to like severe problems reproductive wise, and maybe Joffrey is a result of that. Like, he's just a mad king that I've made, and like, this thing, this lie we've told to build ourselves up is now like working against me to tear me down. It's really great, and they're performing the shit out of this material too.
Yeah, it's one of the few scenes where I feel genuinely sorry for the predicament that Cersei is in. I feel bad for her.
Yeah,
she doesn't get a lot of those scenes, but this one is a really good one.
Yep.
All right, so we go to Catelyn, who dismisses Jaime's guard to call him dismisses Jaime's guard and goes into his cell and calls him a man without honor. And he said he's never been with anyone but Cersei, which makes him more honorable than Ned. Catelyn doesn't really seem to like that, and she asked for Brienne's sword as the scene ends. And Jaime, it's surprising to me because at the end of the scene, Jaime almost looks relieved, like, oh, it's finally going to come to it, right? She's going to put the sword through me, and I'll be off this hook.
Yeah.
I wonder how much he is feeling like he's holding his family hostage.
I think
imprisonment.
He feels that whole weight. Like,
yeah,
if I can't be out there and leading the troops or killing for my family, then I should be dead because that's literally all I'm good for. Like, he said that in like two or three times this whole episode. That, like, you know, this is like, I feel like this exact what the Hound says. Like, I feel like when I'm out there killing, it's like a dream that I've dreamed and it's more real than my real life. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I could see that he would be relieved to have this all over with. And like, again, the line where he's like, you know, you swear to honor your father and you swear to protect your king and you swear to defend the innocent. But what if your father hates the king who wants to slaughter an entire city because he's crazy? Like, you know, where do your vows come in there? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's great.
And he's taking the biggest possible swings he can at Catelyn.
Yeah.
Speaking ill of her dead husband.
I think that's more
leans
evidence
into it. Yeah. At the end, I think he's grateful that he's going to be killed here.
Yeah. Yeah. He just wants it to be over.
Yeah. So final scene is Luwin being dragged into, I guess they're still at the farm there, to see that Theon has burned the bodies
of
Rickon and
Bran. This is when they've come back to Winterfell. Scolding all of the small folk of Winterfell about, see, I fucking told you, look what you made me. He's Taylor Swifting them. Look what you made me do.
When he sees the bodies, he almost turns around and, like, it's hard to read his expression. Like, I don't know
really
what to
make
of it.
It really is.
Is he remorseful about what he's done? Is it just all too horrific for him? Like,
yeah,
I expected it to be bad, but wow, that's bad.
Like Mal, Dag, I thought I knew they'd be dead, but I didn't know that Dagmar is going to go to town and like fucking burn them and their limbs are charred off. And also just the horror of like, look at these dead children, everybody. Like, Theon's a weird duck.
Yeah, he sure is.
He's a strange squid to figure out.
Yeah, that's it for the episode. Anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so. I think we can get, we were safe to go to feedback. Club.baldmove.com is the link you want to go to if you want to join Club Bald Move. You get a lot of cool stuff for doing that. You keep Jim and I making podcasts. Like, direct listener support is how we make the bulk of our money. And you get a lot of things in return. You get ad-free feeds. You get VIP access to the forums. You get a bunch of cool bonus audio and video content, like our extra spoiler reviews of first-run movies, live watches with The Walking Dead, Let's Plays, extra features like Quip. It goes on, and you can get the whole pitch at club.baldmove.com. And also, you get to try the service 30 days free. I mean, 30-day free trial, that's confidence. That's confidence, Jim. That's flopping it out there and saying, look at it. It's worth your money because you're enjoying it. We don't even have your money. What kind of crazy people give away something like that for free?
Us.
It's the confidence in the value of your product to do something like that. Invest with confidence in Bald Move, club.baldmove.com. We have a non-spoiler feedback from Mike from Louisiana. He wants to talk about Jaime and his development this episode. Jaime pushing Bran out the window was horrific and arguably the most consequential act of the series, but I think it pales in comparison to Jaime killing his poor cousin. Think about it. When Jaime tried to kill Bran, he had to make a quick decision to protect the secrets. When Jaime killed his cousin, he was cold, calculating, and cruel. His cousin was literally heaping praises on him and pouring out his soul, but the entire time Jaime viewed him as a piece of meat. Even though I've seen this episode 4 or 5 times, I always dread it because poor cousin Lannister has no clue that his head is about to be bashed in with a chain just to serve as bait for the guard. The act helped him escape, but falls under a high-cost, low-reward category. No, I can't agree more.
I have so little sympathy for the cousin Lannisters. At this point, like, they're all buffoons. We've seen it. Tywin's dismissed half of them because they're all idiots and want to go home. Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about a cousin of a Lannister, I don't care. They're the bad guys.
That's not a very Games of Thrones-y observation.
They're distant relatives of the bad guys at that.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, this guy seems like he's cool.
Yeah, I'm sure he's a shit in his own way.
all Lannisters are evil. Even Tyrion?
And Tyrion's the one exception.
He's the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah. I've never seen him choke anybody in any cousins.
Not a moral. Not well. He chokes up Lancel pretty good.
Yeah,
metaphorically.
Okay.
I mean that's a choke slam if I've ever seen one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. As you could be as satirical as you like, but
yeah,
wrong. I do think that that's what's great, because you're supposed to see like, oh, well, maybe not all the Lannisters are complete shits, and maybe even Jaime had dice, you know, bounce a few different ways, wouldn't be a total shit. But it doesn't matter, because even if this is a shining example of Lannister honor and glory, Jaime's going to beat him down to lube the chain with blood so he can choke Karstark all the better.
Yep.
I mean, it's like, has Jaime never seen a fucking 70s or 80s era fantasy science fiction? Because the play is, get on the ground and flop around, cousin,
mm-hmm.
which would have been just as effective as him actually beating him until he's got the weird kind of like Sean Connery, The Rock twitch going on with his foot. Like, the killing is kind of completely unnecessary.
I think so. Yeah.
And then you have an ally that was already a good squire, which maybe you need. Like, that's what I keep coming to that. It seemed like it was unnecessary. If Jaime had an ounce of literary trope in him, if he had cracked a book, his dyslexic ass had cracked a book or two, I think Alton Lannister is still alive.
Maybe. Or if the guard had maybe been a little bit smarter, Jaime wouldn't
have
got out.
That's true.
This guard's an idiot.
If Lord Karstark had seen the same 70s, 80s era science fiction fantasy show, yeah, he would have known that, like, guards, this man needs help, is like...
Right.
It's like, okay, well, I will call request for backup and send a medical team. Wait for Talisa gets back to save your ass.
And
she'll have a bucket full of milk of the poppy for him.
Right.
You're staying in this cage.
And I actually don't even understand what Karstark's conception of guarding someone is, because he's apparently 15 miles away when this thing happens. Like,
right.
They've been talking. He comes in, he shushes him, and then he fucks off to wherever. I don't know if he's going to the bathroom. I don't know where he is, but he is far away.
And like, we really can only spare one kid to watch this guy. Like,
right, he's
the
most important hostage in all of Westeros.
Shouldn't
Come
there
on.
Be like a team that kind of rotates every couple hours to keep him fresh?
Yeah.
You know, if Rob's going to be this big jailer of people, so he can exchange him or whatever, then you got to do your job right.
Yeah, he talks about how great the Starks are at jailing people. Mm-hmm. And how great they are at being jailed. So
turns out the Karstark's super shit. That's what Kar. It's an old first men modifier. It means bad.
Bad at jailing.
Yeah, like Stark is means like we love being jailed. Kar means no, don't. They're really bad at being prisoners and imprisoning people.
Yep.
It's too bad. It's too bad. So that's the Lone Beast and non-spoiler feedback we got. We've got some more in the spoiler section, but that's for people who have been through the series and the books. Well, the series anyway, because if you're in the series, you're actually way far ahead of the book people.
Yeah.
So feel free to join us if you'd like to give us feedback. It's at gameofthrones@baldmove.com. And we will be back next week for the next episode, and we will be going into the spoiler section right now. See you when we see you. Bye.
All right, let's get into some spoilers. I thought it was interesting to see Theon hunting with dogs in this episode, knowing what's in store for him in the future.
He will be hunted with
dogs.
Yeah,
I know that's a pretty, you know, common occurrence, is hunting with dogs, but it tickled me. And then the other thing with Theon is, I can't remember, refresh my memory, does he know that these are not the boys? He has to, right? Because he would have been informed that they found them.
Right.
If they had.
See, that's the thing. Like, I think that I don't know, and I didn't go back and look at the next episode or refresh my memory of the books, because I think the books are slightly different. Like, it's not, like, the books are less ambiguous. Like, maybe they find a brooch, or maybe I've got that confused with fucking Fellowship of the Ring. But I think the idea is that Bran's better judgment won over, and they skipped the farm, and Dagmar somehow planted those walnuts.
Okay.
And yeah, I do think Theon knows, which is weird. Like, I can't explain his the only thing I can explain his reaction is that, like, as they're hauling up these boys on the wall, the full weight of what he's doing,
yeah,
and the type of leader that he is falling upon him, and he's kind of horrified at himself.
Because those are real boys, obviously, that were killed.
Yeah.
So
those are the...
Despite them not being Brandon Rickon, it's still two boys.
Right.
So, still horrific.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of how we find out that that's fake. Because at some point, or maybe this is a book-only plot that... Hodor and the boys and Asha and the wolves are hiding out in the crypts of Winterfell. Because when Winterfell kind of gets sacked, that's certainly where they're at. So, but I'm kind of fuzzy on the details there. The thing I want to talk about was Arya's meal with Tywin, and I'm thinking like in terms of season 7, where Arya. And we don't know exactly how much of this is quote unquote real, because we've got stories of like all this alternate stuff they filmed, but it didn't make it to the end. And like how genuine was Arya's like outrage with Sansa, and how much of that was just like play acting to try to figure out what her sister's true motivations were. She's kind of like playing the lying game. But I kept on thinking, like, what if Sansa like had a fly in the wall and she sees like it's not very clear that Arya wants to kill Tywin, but she's sharing a meal with him and kind of taking a shine to him and doing the thing that she needs to do to survive and keep alive and get revenge for the family. Yet she judges Sansa for, you know, writing a letter and you know, playing this game of court footsie with Cersei and Joffrey and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the delicious thing is Sansa can't throw that in her face because she knows nothing of it.
Right.
Arya knows all this shit about Sansa, but it's very asymmetric. But it's something that's kind of funny when you get later on into the series. Any other kind of points we want to make to get right to the feedback?
Let's get to the feedback.
Okay, once again, GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. Jonathan H. is first. Does Brienne come across as completely ridiculous to anyone else? Let's counter fuck ups. 1, let Renly die. 2, lost control of Jaime. 3, bested the Hound, but in so doing ruined Arya's hopes of reaching Winterfell. She seems like this duty-bound, allegiance-swearing wrecking ball that does more harm than good. I guess this isn't much of a question, but I want to hear your thoughts.
I mean, I feel like blind honor and devotion has always kind of been a wrecking ball.
I mean
yeah. Look at the Starks, right?
Yeah, and right.
So in as much as she embodies that, like the Starks do, yeah, sure.
The thing is like, she's even... worse or better depending on your perspective, because like Ned did compromise his honor and integrity by taking the plea deal and lying to the realm to preserve his daughters. Rob besmirches his personal honor by reneging on his marriage contract and ultimately destroying his kingship because of his, like, you know, essentially carnal selfishness.
Come on, John's stronger than you are, Rob.
Yeah, whereas Brienne, like, doesn't really have any of, certainly not so far. And also, let Renly die? What the hell would anyone do to stop the supernatural shadow baby that you didn't even know existed?
Get a big light. Big old candle.
Right, like, set Renly on fire and he would have been warm for the rest of his life. Like, I don't know that you can say that she let Renly die.
No, that's not on her.
I know there was no defense. She has no defense against that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, losing control of Jaime, he's one of the best killers in the land.
Yeah.
And like the best thing, the Hound, like that's the other thing is like both the Hound and Brienne were doing what they thought was best for Arya, and what they thought best was killing each other. So like, I don't know. I don't think she's ridiculous at all. I like Brienne a lot.
Me too.
So I can't go along with you on that one, Jonathan. Patrick F., I was pretty surprised that you're reading the scene of last week when the Half-Hand gives John to kill Ygritte, or leaves John to kill Ygritte. Why, I think your hypothesis that it was because he expected John to rape is valid and fits the character presented on screen. Certainly not how it goes down in the books. If I remember correctly, Corrin later reveals his motivation for leaving John alone to kill Ygritte was because he knew he wouldn't kill her, thereby adding to his credentials when he turns double agent. Corrin says something along the lines of, if I want someone to torture a wildling, I'd ask Eben. If I wanted someone to climb a mountain, I'd ask Stone Snake. But I ask you to do this task, basically revealing he knows his men inside and out. I know the show changed Korin's character somewhat, but in his estimation, they 5 out of 10 executed a great plot line, in my opinion. But to suggest he expected him to rape her seems pretty far removed from the book character. Hmm. Yeah, I agree. And that's the one thing I was going to make at the tail end of Korin's story, is that I was pretty disappointed with how they handled this. Because in the books, there's this great scene of, like, you know, Korin and his handpicked team. And there's always, like, these moments of, like, you know, Korin make the observations, like, from that rocky crag, a man that's good with the bow could hold off men for a good long while till he ran out of arrows. And, like, the best archer in the group would stand up and be like, yep, you're right, and just solemnly go off to fucking die to give, like, there's this running battle between these dwindling group of, like, badasses against all these wildings. It's very fucking Black Hawk Down. It's very Lone Survivor. And, like, I eat that shit up. And then you're right at the end when, you know, John gets captured and they've got this, they, like, Korin reveals that, like, that's kind of like his ace up the sleeve, that John's natural pity and kind of stupidity with the enemy would make it him a better turn cloak.
I didn't pick up on any of that.
Right.
From last episode.
You don't. And that's what it's like. I was pointing out this, like, you know, without that knowledge, it just makes it. I think that maybe the Double D's leaned into that because, like, you know, it seems like 60 more seconds and you could have told a lot of that story, or maybe 2 minutes over the course of the season. But you got to decide with trim and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And the way they trimmed it, it gives it this kind of, like, another additional layer of gray to the Night's Watch. That this guy who's been battling these guys for decades is kind of so cynical and grizzled that he would, you know, it's another kind of, like, disillusionment that John has to go through. Because that's the thing. Like, this is the beginning of John's path where he sees a way to unify the Wildlings and the Night's Watch and sees that against the real threat of these old gods that Craster worships, this enmity between the Night's Watch and the Wildlings is stupid.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, as presented in the show, it feels like maybe that never should have happened. But yeah, when you throw in the book knowledge, which I'm not privy to.
Let's continue with Melanie R. I got caught up in your podcast. I want to let you know that I recently watched a commentary by Gurm on episode 209, The Blackwater.
He said, Winds of Winter is coming out in 3 weeks.
Got 90% of it written. Where he comments about how he wanted to include the chain, but there was no budget for it. They invested most of it in the boat they created and decided to drop the chain, pun intended.
Okay.
There again, like, how fucking expensive is it to animate a chain coming out of the water? It could probably be a practical effect and then CGI a couple of...
exploding boats?
Well, I mean, I just, like, when they say, like, we spent all our money on zombie polar bears so we couldn't afford a few seconds of ghost. Like, that just really doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
And to me, the chain is kind of, like, what really makes it, like, a uniquely kind of Tyrion trap.
Right.
And really amps up the cleverness. So, like, I mean, I guess I just don't understand how they decide what is worth budget and what isn't on this show.
Yeah, I guess the earlier and earlier you go in the show, the more I'm willing to give them that.
Right.
Like, look, we didn't have the budget.
Right.
You get to season 7. Come on, you're making the biggest show on television.
Right.
Don't tell me you can't afford it.
Yeah, for something. And it's not like a little thing. Like, Ghost is, like, one of these big fan favorites. And the other thing is, like, if I remember correctly, I was not very impressed with the mock boats they have. Like, they look like sound stages that are of a... they don't even try to CGI water. It's just like they're on a gloomy set. It's like, and this is like, you know, I know what a real boat looks like, what real rigging, and they don't nail any of it. It feels very stagey.
Yeah.
So, like, hearing that, and I guess you're talking about this is like on the DVD commentaries. Astounds me. Astounds me that the CGI boat budget, or the practical boat budget, sucked up all the chain budget. Sean from North, I'm going to try to say this, Kakalaki.
No, yeah, that sounds right. Kakalaki.
Krakalaka. Wow. I am fully caught up with Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire and have been following your season 2 rewatch. Well, thanks. I agree with your and many others' opinions that Tywin, Faerûs swap in Harrenhal and the resulting relationship with Arya is one of the most enjoyable parts of season 2 and the entire show, but This aspect is mostly unique to the show and presumably spearheaded by the Double D's as writers for the new dialogue and scenes. Can this storyline be used as proof that the showrunners and associated writing team is capable of generating compelling original content in the bounds of the Game of Thrones story, and that the generally plot hole ridden and immersion breaking only show only plots of season 6 and 7 are evidence of other underlying issues? In my opinion, it's not uncommon for shows to become lazy with story details once they achieve critical acclaim and general popularity. But do you think this points to a decline in care for the show over time, or is this a situation different enough not to provide for fair comparison to the bullet point style resource material for season 6 and 7?
My guess is the thing that's causing all the problems in season 7, as far as plotting goes, is time. Not having the episodes they need to really fully flesh out the story and get to the end point that they're heading for.
But it's so weird because...
I know they could have more time, but it's also... It comes down to burnout for the Double D's, right? Like, they don't want to continue to produce this for another 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah,
they just want to finish the story and be done with it. And I can't blame them. I mean, they've been doing this for 8 years now.
Okay, so, like, I feel like I've carried enough water for the Double D's, I can say, like, from the other side that, like, much like Game of Thrones itself, there are no heroes here. Like... George should have, in my estimation, buckled the fuck down and gotten another book or two out, or decided that's never going to happen, so I'm going to more directly collaborate to make sure this, you know, is the best version of my vision. It seems like instead there's been a little bit of a rift in their creative relationship because, like, well, I don't have time to fucking finish my books. I certainly don't have time to write a script or sit in a writer's room. And also... this thing about the Double D's, like, getting sick of Game of Thrones, again, fucking buck up, dudes. Like, there is...
I mean, that's easy to say, looking in from the outside.
That's
the easiest thing in the world.
Look, I have, like, it's, you know, being a podcaster is not all, you know, roses either. There is many days that I don't feel like fucking doing this, but on the other hand, I have a contract with people that expect this shit to get done, and they're delivering on that, and they provide my life. But
the work is suffering, certainly, and you could see it suffering under those circumstances. They haven't, you know, failed in any of their obligations necessarily. They've simply been.
I just do feel like they're not. They are. There's a little bit of fuck it. Let's just get through this. And I think that in a perfect world, these guys would stay creatively engaged throughout the whole process and try that much harder.
As soon as you find the perfect world, let me know.
Well, and maybe it's because, like, again, this is where it gets blurry, because the bullet points, I think, it's one thing to have a building that's all fleshed out and you get to the sixth floor and it's like, oh, we wanted a waterfall here. It's just going to have to be a blank wall because we don't have the budget for it. Mm. It's a whole other. It's like floors 6 and 7 don't exist. Let's get the water. Well, the waterfall's half built and we ran out of money. Shit. What are we going to do? You know, well, try to, you know, put his best spotlight on it and move on. Like, I do think maybe they'd be more energized and engaged if they were having this streamlining role. And it's a lot easier to, you know, make a plain wall look prettier if you knew that it has to be plain because we don't have the budget for it. Then you get halfway through the waterfall and, like, well, shit, we just have to somehow, you know, fucking have an ice dragon here.
I mean, I'm not disagreeing that there's plenty of blame to go around, and that Martin is partially responsible, the Double D's are partially responsible.
And that's what I'm saying.
And I'm not saying that makes them blameless. It's just... an understandable thing.
And I do think it's interesting that, like, some in the community, like, it seems like preponderance of fan wants to always throw it back to the Double D's as being the ultimate betrayers when the god of the universe stopped on day 5 of creation. Like, you know, how can anyone care more about this goddamn story than George Martin? So, like, I think he's the most at fault. And then if the Double D's... And I don't know their pressures. Like, they're living this shit 24/7 in a way I can't. Like, I certainly don't as a podcaster. But I do wish they cared maybe a little bit more.
Okay.
Because there is multiple times when I was listening to their own goddamn words where they're saying, like, well, this wasn't great, but it's the best we could come up with the time and budget restraints. Who are putting the time and budget restraints on them? Ultimately, like, if they went back and said, I need another episode and it's going to delay... season 8 another month. Well, who cares? Who
yeah,
cares?
That's the thing. I don't think you can blame this on time, like actual time in production schedules and budget.
Right.
Because I think you will have as much leeway as you need on those things if you simply ask for it.
Also, apropos of this,
and truly need it.
This conversation, someone dug up a quote from George Martin, I think it was October 15th, 2007, where he said, you know, in 10 years when the books are finished, no one's going to remember how long it took to in between the books. They're going to remember how good they were. And 10 years later, there's still two books that haven't come out. They may never come out.
Yeah.
And I guarantee, George, what people will remember if the books never get finished is the books never got finished.
That's true.
So, gee, it's kind of a shit show. Okay, Jeremy, OC. The day before Renly is killed by a shadow baby from the Big Red's Vag, the two brothers meet on a bluff to chat, with Kat there too. For some reason in the books, Renly offers Stannis a peach. He doesn't take it, but he's confused by the offer, and I am too. What the hell is Renly doing? A friend of mine is a teacher of difficult kids, and she says she will often eat an apple in front of a student who's near the boiling point. She says you never look stressed while eating an apple, and it calms everyone down. Is this what Renly, the weird fruit-loving usurper, was up to? Would love your thoughts.
Wow. I have no response for that. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, at first I'm like, well, this is interesting. But then I think, like, the idea of, like, someone kind of offhandly eating fruit in front of, like, it reminds
me
of, like...
He is, too. There's a scene in the show where he's eating fruit.
Sure, and it reminds me of, like, Cool Hand Luke, where the boss is, like, carving in apples as he's laying down the law. And, like, there's, like, other scenes like that where it is kind of, like, this person's doing this very casual thing. It's like if they were trimming their toenails in front of you, it'd be kind of the same thing.
Like Tywin cleaning the deer.
Yeah. It's like it's a little bit of a power game. I do think in the book it's more... Because if I recall correctly, the scene is like Stannis is like thinking about his brother and he's feeling guilty about it and kind of the underhanded way he won and how hinky it was and like grappling with the idea that like he really did love his brothers in some deep down place of him and he can't quite articulate it. And he's like, to him, the peach is kind of like, you know, Rosebud. Like he's assigning a deeper meaning to it because he... Mm-hmm. What else can he say? I love my brother.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Wow.
It's the weirdest email. Is this the weirdest email we've ever considered?
I thought it was super weird.
Okay, we'll move on then. Hunter from Birmingham, Alabama. Had a quick thought about Bronn's character moving into season 8 with Jaime AWOL and the Tarleys both dead. Who will Cersei choose to lead the Lannister army? It seems Bronn is the only one left in King's Landing that's a ranking officer for the Lannister army, so it would make sense to put him in charge? That would be quite the arc from his sellsword from season 1. My gut tells me he would follow Jaime to Winterfell, but do you think if he was going to do that, he would have left with him? This leads me to believe he has another purpose in King's Landing. Do you see Bronn as supreme commander of the Lannister army?
Yeah. I mean, Bronn's climbing the ladders, right? Climbing the rungs. He's also the guy who's going to back the right horse.
Yeah.
You know? And if he sees that the Lannisters are weak, he's not going to back that horse anymore. But yeah, I mean, he's... Who else? The Mountain? The Mountain in charge.
Yeah, the Undead Mountain. Uh-huh. I thought, like, if anyone's probably going to lead it, it'd be Euron, assuming he doesn't betray Cersei. Okay. But, like, Bronn, I'm like... I mean, maybe that is that there is literally no one else, but I'm thinking, like, any minor or major lord that's still left in Tywin's old bannermen, like, the idea that Bronn would be leading them would be some kind of fucking joke.
Yeah, we talked about...
And it looked like there was competent Lannister commanders left because Jaime was meeting with them. Kevin's dead.
Kevin's dead.
He got blown up in the Sept. In the books, he got stabbed to death the way.
Okay. One of the many people to perish in the Sept.
Yeah. So, but they showed Jaime meeting with his commanders, and they seem like they're professional and competent. So I imagine one of those guys would do it. Yeah. But the other thing is, like, you know. Related to the conversation you said about the double D's, like when you said, yeah, sure, I can see that, like my heart sinks because I'm thinking like all this history and how he's this very up jumped, rough around the edges sellsword and how none of the professional soldiers would want to follow him. But if you're as a guy is like, sure, yeah, that sounds good. Like I feel like the double D's will like say the same thing. They're like,
I mean,
fuck
he might
it,
be
not?
In a Theon situation where nobody respects him, but I think he would probably.
I don't think Bronn would ever be
in
a Theon situation.
No, well, I think, well, in as much as they don't respect
okay,
him.
Okay, sure.
Maybe he can instill some respect.
Yeah, I think the first time that guy lips him off, like, tries to leave in a boat, he's holding his own guts. And then, like, this is why you don't give me shit.
Well, that's not respect. That's fear.
Well, you know.
But my larger point is he is an opportunist. And we've seen that time and time again. And as soon as he thinks there's an opportunity to jump on that could be successful for him, he takes it. Now, I think he might change his mind. Once he sees kind of the more, a little more of the devastation that the dragons can bring to a castle.
Yeah.
You know, he's seen it in the field, so he should be well aware. But I think once he realizes there is no safe place, he might turn that opportunity down. Sure.
I'm still holding out hope for the Dornish Gambit.
Yeah. I just don't know. Yeah, you'd have to. I think Euron is the most likely one.
Yeah. Okay, so Fern from NYC is going to bat clean up here. Been rewatching season 7, and I've had some thoughts. Everyone assumes the Night's King will go north. Will go north to south with the Army of the Dead, and his main army most likely will. But my question is, now that the Night's King has a dragon, and seeing Dany fly from Dragonstone to Eastwatch faster than Jim driving Chipotle for lunch, could the Night's King swing around Westeros with his dragon and strike King's Landing with his dragon? Wait, what did I just say? Could Night's King swing around Westeros with his dragon and strike King's Landing with his dragon? Okay.
Yep.
I earned that double dragon. Even if he went alone, he just need to kill a handful of people to make them his army, or just raise the dead that are already in King's Landing. Could Cersei meet her in by the Night's King before the North even fight the Army of the Dead? White Cersei, anyone? W-I-G-H-T. Hell, if dragon is a white, then it should have dead raising abilities as well.
This is spinning. This is spinning off into
Fern, you've done speculated yourself into a tizzy.
I think the Night King has maybe fucked himself with this dragon, because the dragon's fire is going to burn up all of his potential army.
Right.
If he decides to use it.
I'm going to make a further Chipotle-based analogy.
Okay.
Jim no longer rushes like a madman to Chipotle. Jim orders online, secure in the knowledge that when he arrives, the burrito will be waiting for him.
I'm a tactician.
The Night King similarly has preordained that he's going to get King's Landing and is in no particular hurry to mosey down. He's got oceans of time to conquer Westeros. That burrito will be waiting for him in King's Landing.
Yep.
I don't... No, like, it seems like the story of the Night's King has been slow and patient accumulation of power. But as Fern says, he does have the dragon, which he didn't have before. So,
yeah, no, it's I don't really know what he's going to do with it.
Yeah,
like it changes the game certainly, but I don't know to what degree.
As far as him, like, raising dead and how old a dead he could, like, no one really knows that stuff. Like, people have pointed to, like, how the Stark royalty has, like, always been interred in, like, the crypts of Winterfell with, like, some kind of, like, potentially magical protection, because all their kings have these iron swords across their laps, and people, like, it's like, well, in most traditions, iron is, like, proof against undead and magic and all, but, like, who the fuck knows?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if the Night King can resurrect anyone who's ever died ever, but... that would be scary, but we've never really seen him do that. We've seen, like, really old dead, but, like, those could have been, like, whites that have been laying around for centuries, if not millennia.
Yeah.
I don't know if he can just, like, empty the graveyards out, like some kind of fucking Night on Bald Mountain situation.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know what effect the dragon's fire would have on people. Would it turn them?
Right.
Would it burn them up?
Right.
I guess that could be interesting.
The dragon is a real gray area, because, like, they've always said the dragons are not just mere beasts. There is some kind of intelligence there. So maybe they could be, like, a full White Walker dragon and could start raising. But, like, then again, I don't know that they're that close to human intelligence. Like, I don't know if they're going to be able to master the gloating-based language that is required to weave the spells that pull the dead out of the ground. No one knows. It seems like it would have this weird thing where it really completely makes the machinations down south worth nothing. Like, if the Night King comes while, you know, Jon and Dany are dreading dealing with King's Landing and nukes King's Landing, and then goes back up north, and what are we even fighting for now?
Yeah.
So, I mean, could the Night King fly to the Summer Isles? Could he fly to Southeros or whatever? Like sure. There's also this thing of, like, the winter comes with the Night King. Can he just, like, you know, go to hit a tropical beach and start raising dead? I honestly don't know. I wish I did. I wish I knew more about their limitations and strengths and weaknesses. But whatever. We got 6 more episodes to go.
We do.
That's it. Again, GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. If you'd like to send us feedback, you can also go to forums.baldmove.com. To talk with your fellow fans and follow us on all the social medias and, of course, baldmove.com to find to keep up with what we're doing, because we're doing stuff all the time. Got a really big week ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty excited. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.